it's great to be with you. So I just want to make sure I'm using a lapel mic. And so I'm a wanderer, just like Mark Mitchell, but I was speaking last weekend in Billings, Montana, and I realized when you're on crutches on a stage and you start wandering on the stage, it stresses everyone out. So I'm going to try, actually. I would always notice, like, it's getting tense. And I finally realized everybody's waiting for me to march off the stage. So I'm just going to try to stand still. It's just that my sort of vocal function and my body functions are connected in some way. And so I have a hard time articulating my thoughts sometimes without moving. So don't worry. Even if I don't have the crutches, I can still stand up. And if you're wondering, I missed the top stair on our DC townhouse and snapped my patellar tendon on the way down the stairs. So, yeah, so don't do that. Just grab on to the railing. Well, I want to talk to you for a few minutes, and in some ways, I see my project, certainly in this book, The Human Advantage, the last couple of things that I've done, as trying to tie together sort of contentious tendencies and threads among conservatives, among American conservatives. I think of myself as basically a traditional American conservative that ties together commitment to limited government and individual rights and moral traditionalism and a clear and distinct sort of understanding of national identity, which is both generous and specific, with economic literacy. And I didn't actually imagine I would spend maybe half of my life, and maybe it'll end up being more than that, just trying to convince either people on the left or on the right that there are economic truths, that there are some things that are actually true, that economists are not just people bickering about political ideology, even though that's a major part of the mix, but that economics, when it's doing its best, leads to a sort of understanding of certain regularities that emerge from certain types of human social interactions that might otherwise look chaotic. And that if we're going to be responsible when it comes to public policy, if we're going to have a responsible political philosophy, we want to find out what are those economic truths like? We need to, what's economic reality like? And it's not like the kind of confusion on these points is the exclusive jurisdiction of people on the left. It's no one's exclusive jurisdiction. Lots of us are confused about sort of basic economics. And there are, at least I would argue, in a yet published paper, at least 30 key propositions that all economists basically know and that we should take them for granted in our political philosophy. So in The Human Advantage, my main goal, I guess I had multiple goals, but it is to first figure out what is the information economy? What makes it different? We have this intuitive sense that the information economy is different in certain ways from, you know, we'll call it the kind of industrial economy, which itself in some ways replaced the agrarian economy. At the time of the American founding, 95% of the population lived and worked on farms. Today it's less, well, way down past 2%, approaching 1% of the population. That doesn't mean we don't eat. It just means that the sort of arrangements have changed dramatically in terms of our capacity to produce enough food in various ways, and so people do lots of different things. But at any particular moment in economic history, especially at these inflection points, say the major transformation that took place in the West over 150 years or so, from the agrarian to the industrial sort of stage of economic development, someone could have looked at what people were doing and, say, looked in 1776 at the steam engine and said, gosh, we're going to get really, really productive at agriculture the moment 95% of the population is working on farms. What's going to happen in 150 years? Maybe 90% of the population won't be needed to do that. That means we're going to have, what, like 94% unemployment or something? Nobody's going to have anything to do, right? Now, it sounds silly now. In retrospect, it wouldn't have been silly at the time. If you think about most people at the time of the founding, they didn't have a plan B, right? They didn't have multiple different kinds of importable skills that they could reallocate to something else. And you, certainly all the jobs that exist now didn't exist in 1776. So you could imagine the jobs that would be lost. Right? You could picture them. You couldn't imagine because you couldn't possibly know the types of jobs that would emerge in a completely different kind of economic environment when we're spending way less of our income on food. And so this economists will be quick when you hear these sort of arguments from technologists, both dystopians and utopians, that whatever the current technology is going to leave us out of work. Economists say that's the lump of labor fallacy. There's not just a fixed amount of work to be done, and once that's done by, you know, say, a man in a tractor, then nobody's going to be needed to do anything else. We find other things to do. We find other types of value to create. And I actually think that economic argument is exactly right. But what you ought to know if you're not sort of haven't delved deeply into the technology literature is that universally people say this time it's different. This time it really is different. And if you want to read just one book that sort of articulates this point, it's by Martin Ford called The Rise of the Robots. And he's kind of the foil in my book just because he manages to encapsulate, I think, this mistake. But here's what he says. He says, the shift now underway will ultimately challenge one of our most basic assumptions about technology, that machines are tools that increase the productivity of workers. Instead, machines themselves are turning into workers. So rather than our machines enhancing our labor, like a tractor, they are literally going to replace not just, you know, the sort of tools that we use, they're going to become the workers. They are literally going to replace us, or at least replace, if you listen to the reports of all the officially smart people in the last couple of years, about 50% of jobs sometime in the next 20 years. It's funny how these kinds of ideas that have this weird precision suddenly become the consensus, but that's what it is. It's about 20 years out, half the jobs in the developed world are going to get replaced by machines. All right, so that's the story. Now, some people that tell you this will say it's going to be a disaster, and so we need a universal basic income to pay everybody because they don't have anything to do. Right? The other side said, this is the utopian side, it's going to be awesome because we don't have to work anymore and we just need a universal basic income to give us some money. And so there's a total consensus on this point. Notice the shared premise that machines will replace us. Now, any philosophers in the room will realize that in order for a machine to literally replace us in all of our capacities, it would have to be equivalent to us. And the easiest way to make that assumption is to assume ahead of time that we are machines. And so if you, like maybe Elon Musk or Ray Kurzweil at the Google Corporation, assume that we are machines, or like Marvin Minsky, that the brain is just a machine made of meat, then you should probably be worried. Because if we're just machines that are the result of this blind and impersonal process over cosmic time, and we suddenly kind of emerge and we're conscious and we make technology, maybe we're just the inflection point, the end of the biological age of cosmic evolution that's about to be taken over by the technological age. And we will, if all goes well, at least be able to upload ourselves to the sort of Internet 5.0 and leave this mortal coil behind. That's the ultimate kind of utopian vision. I'm not going to spend any time on it because I'm certain everyone in this room thinks that's highly dystopian and absolutely mistaken. But I want to sort of start with my conclusion. Is this true that machines or robots are going to replace us and so ultimately replace the things that we do? My sort of response to this is absolutely don't buy it. And if you can find a way to invest your money against this thesis. Now, I'm not an investment counselor, but I would advise it because there's a group of people that is absolutely convinced that they're going to create the first general artificial intelligence. They are going to make machines that are conscious, and they are going to replace us. Right? And that's going to, if that happens, that's going to have huge implications. But people that are spending a lot of their time on that, there's other people that think, no, that's actually misconceived, and they're doing other things. And so these things, the nice thing about these predictions is they usually have sell-by dates on them. Ray Kurzweil is giving us 2043. They're usually just far enough out that they're hoping to be gone by the time it's falsified, you know. But this isn't what we should worry about with the information economy. It should not be long-term permanent technological unemployment. Now, there is a challenge to the information economy, but it's not that. The real challenge to the information economy, it's not the end of work, it's the accelerating pace of change and disruption, both in the workforce and in culture. Things change so quickly that whereas, for instance, you know, that transition from farm to city that my grandparents experienced, right on the cusp of that, happened over a period of about 150 years, the kind of major disruption. Whereas in my lifetime, let's just take one technology, the way we transmit and store music. LPs, 8-track tapes, that's when my dad, he heavily invested in 8-track tapes. Cassette tapes, CDs. I haven't bought a CD in 9 years for music. It's MP3 files, right, which we download or we stream. We've moved entirely from the world of atoms, this is how technologists put it, to the world of bits. We store our music as files. They're bits. Now, there's physical infrastructure, but that's just one thing. And so that gives you a taste of how quickly things will change. And so I think our sort of job to do, if you think humans are not machines, and I've got a whole other argument, a philosophical argument for why we shouldn't think that's the case, but I'm just going to assume it. If we are not machines, then what we want to know is, okay, what's likely to happen given the properties of the information economy so that we essentially know how to adapt to it and to flourish rather than to, say, be left behind or simply not know how to adapt. So I would argue there are 5 main features of the information economy, and I'll give them to you here at the beginning because I'm going to sort of fly through these. This is essentially my distillation of the literature on information economics, which is sort of fast becoming its own subspecialty. And here they are. It's highly disruptive, which I've already mentioned. We can treat that mainly as a cost. It's exponential in its growth, that is in the information sectors. It's digital, that's 3. It's hyper-connected, which is obvious, and it's ever more informational. Right, so the disruption should be sort of obvious to you, right? And so I'm not going to spend a lot of time proving that to you. But what do I mean by exponential? I suspect most of you have heard of Moore's Law, named after Gordon Moore, the co-founder of the Intel Corporation. But the term refers to a prediction he made in 1965 when he wrote a paper when he noticed that engineers every 18 to 24 months were able to put twice the number of transistors on an integrated circuit as they had been able to 18 to 24 months before. So they were doubling at least every 2 years the number of transistors they could get on a single integrated circuit. That's exponential growth, right? As opposed to the kind of growth we're used to, 1, 2, 5, 6, 7, 8. It's 2, 4, 6, 8, 16, 32, 64, 128, 256, and on you go. Right? That's exponential growth. He predicted it would happen for maybe 10 more years. That was in 1965. It's still going. All right. Now, it doesn't necessarily intuitively seem all that significant. You might think, well, that just maybe has to do with crystalline silica, with the physics of the thing that folks were using at the time and that we're still using to build computer brains. Maybe this isn't a sort of larger trend. But a guy named Ray Kurzweil, whom I've just mentioned, and he's sort of the leading transhumanist, is both some very interesting ideas and predictions and some really far out stuff. Including that thing about uploading ourselves to the internet, right? And writes a lot about what it's going to be like to have sex simultaneously. I don't know why he's fixated on this. This is sort of one of his things. But he's now a vice president at Google, okay? So if you think he's tinfoil hat stuff, no, this is a very popular idea, mostly in California, granted. But there are a lot of people think this. But Kurzweil has been very good at recognizing trends. And he thought, okay, let's look at this trend of Moore's Law across the 20th century, because he knew that in the 20th century there had been 5 fundamentally different physical media in which computation had taken place. The integrated circuit's just the one we're using now, but at the beginning of the 19th century it was a sort of electromechanical, and then you had a relay system and you had a vacuum tube. We ended up in the integrated circuits now. And he changed it. He said, okay, he figured out, how much computation could you get for $1,000 at any one time in the 20th century? And then he charted it, and you know what he found? Moore's Law has continued throughout the 20th century across 5 different physical platforms. And then he found a bunch of other examples of this, and he completely overplayed the thesis and applies it to everything. Nevertheless, he discovered this weird trend of exponential growth in a lot of digital technologies. And it's still happening in integrated circuits. Every year somebody predicts we're about at the end of it. But what's funny is just that doubling every 2 years is trivial compared to the exponential growth in other parts of the tech sector, like store width, for instance, our capacity for storage. George Gilder in Life After Google gives some examples. He says, actually, Moore's Law with computer chips is trivial compared to some of the exponential growth in other places. And it's this exponential growth that I would maintain in certain, what I'm calling the information sectors, that leads to such disruption because of the capacities that are changed. It's that and then the second feature, the third feature. So it's disruptive, it's exponential, it's digital. Now, most people use the word digital. Few of us actually know what it means. I actually, for a long time, thought it meant a watch with numbers rather than dials. I'm sure for years that's what I thought the word meant. Digital just refers to the language native to computers, to the binary of 0 and 1, like your two digits here. But the economy is becoming ever more digital. Now, that might not be obvious what that means. So let me give you an example of this, because it's hugely significant economically. Think of an Encyclopedia Britannica set, perhaps, right? The Philadelphia Society. One of you probably has the whole set. But for a long time, this was a sort of status symbol among upper-middle-class people. You can still buy the whole physical set, right? Now, economists say that's a rival good. A rival good is just something that if you have it, somebody else can't have it. It takes up space. It takes paper and glue and cardboard. It has to be transported. If I have it in my library, in my house, you can't have it in your house, right? So it's a rival good. Moreover, it never gets anywhere near zero marginal cost of production. Maybe the company could produce 1 million sets and get that marginal cost down if they produce it in China or something. Pretty low. But it's still going to take paper and glue and ink, and it's going to have to be transported and all these things. So it's always going to have a kind of significant marginal cost. It's a rival good, and it never approaches zero marginal cost. Now change the scenario to a subscription online to the Encyclopedia Britannica, $69, way cheaper. Actually better, because it's constantly updated, and you get video and stuff like that. Now if I, say, buy a subscription for the year, have I depleted the store of subscriptions from a warehouse? No. If someone downloads a song on iTunes for $1.29, have they reduced by one the number of those? No. Digital goods are inherently non-rival. This is a weird kind of abundance that distinguishes them from physical goods, which are almost always rival. The other thing is that they approach zero marginal cost. So once the infrastructure is in place, right, the internet and fiber optic cables and your computers and everything, the cost to Encyclopedia Britannica of your subscription is very close to zero. So they're basically, digital goods are non-rival, and they approach zero marginal cost. That's huge, because that means the more of the economy that becomes digital moves from the weird kind of general world of scarcity in the world of atoms to a weird world of abundance in the realm of bits. That's digitization. So the question is, now we live in the world of atoms, right? Despite what the transhumanists think we're going, we still live in the world of molecules and atoms. And so the question is how we're going to integrate those things. But if you want to know, okay, why do things seem different? This is a fundamental difference, and there's some smart economists that picked this up already some years ago. Next to last, we're hyper-connected. So 200 years ago or so, the fastest that one person could communicate with another person at some distance would have been what? Been the speed of one man on the fastest horse he could find, right? The Pony Express. It's as fast as you could communicate with other people. There's a one exception that actually had to do with village drums in sub-Saharan Africa. Villages were able to communicate with each other, but we didn't know that until somewhat recently. The missionaries just thought it was noise. They didn't know what was happening. They're like, missionaries are coming. But that was basically the fastest you could communicate, you know. Think about it now, though. I mean, we've all got smartphones on us, almost certainly, right? Close to half the population of the entire planet, of the human race, is connected to each other in some sense at roughly the speed of light. And the total number is going up all the time. And the interconnections continue to multiply, for good or ill. Right now, I'm just trying to describe. I'm not saying this is a good or bad thing. I'm saying this is what's happening. And so we're much, much more connected. And I'm acutely aware of the bad because I'm on Twitter. But it also creates all sorts of different kinds of opportunities. And then finally, it's ever more informational, which again requires us to ask, okay, what's information? This is the beating heart of the question, and I think the beating heart of my argument. What is information? If you study computer theory, you know that information is described following Claude Shannon in terms of surprise. Did George Gilder talk about this, by the way? Not at all? Okay. Because I was hoping he would cover this, maybe. Yeah. So let me give you an example. So if you want to figure out how much information something has, let's say I have a quarter, and I say, okay, it could be heads or tails, right? So right now we don't know if it's heads or tails. And then I flip it, and it comes up tails. Then the language of computer theory, that's one bit of information. And then if I flipped it 10 times and recorded the sequence of heads and tails, that would be a certain number of bits. We can measure the amount of information in it. That's an amazing thing, because information doesn't have weight, doesn't have a smell, it doesn't have volume, it's not in any particular location, and yet we can measure it mathematically. So this is a remarkable kind of discovery and realization on the part of Claude Shannon. But Shannon's understanding of information doesn't really capture what we mean by information. And here's why. A random sequence of letters, literally random, and those same letters rearranged to spell methinks it's like a weasel, have exactly the same amount of information in Shannon's terms. So you know, okay, something's missing there. Yeah, he reduced information for his purposes just to complexity or improbability, but left out the most important part, the part that we immediately recognize. I don't know how many of you have ever been to Victoria in British Columbia during the summer, but if you take a ferry into the inner harbor of Victoria and the sun is up, you'll notice a sort of red pattern on the grassy knoll on the edge, the very edge before you get off the ferry. And as you get closer, you'll discover it actually says something in red and yellow begonias. Welcome to Victoria. And you see it immediately. Once you see it, right, you don't spend any time saying, okay, what's the probability that Canada geese flew south, you know, and dropped a bunch of red and yellow begonia seeds, and they just fell out in that pattern. Is that logically possible? I suppose. And here's the funny thing. Any random pattern would be complex and improbable. But we know that wouldn't be information, right? So how do we immediately recognize that that's an informational pattern when we see Welcome to Victoria? It's this combination of both that complexity and also this independently given pattern that we can just call meaning. And meaning is the exclusive jurisdiction of intelligent agents. When you see that, it is a person or a group of people drawing on your background knowledge of where you are. You're in Victoria, knowing English, knowing how English is spelled, and so you immediately recognize the activity of an intelligent agent. The information theorist Henry Kwasser said, we habitually associate the production of new information with the activity of intelligent agents. Now, why does this matter? Because if that's right, and I could spend a bunch of time trying to persuade you that this is true, we're the only ones that produce large amounts of meaningful information. The information economy is ultimately about producing certain types of meaning. And so if machines cannot do that, they can transmit and store and calculate and sort, but cannot produce new meaning, then the information economy is not going to be one that replaces us or alienates us. It's going to be one that actually reflects our own capacities as creatures made in the image of God, just like every other economy, with its own challenges and opportunities. So the information economy, what you might initially have thought, okay, this is, things are getting weird and digital and ghostly and there's bits rather than atoms, I don't like the way this is sounding, is still ultimately fundamentally about us and our capacities to produce meaning. And so if you thought I was going to say, you know, the way we adapt to the information economy is that we learn to code, that's actually not the answer. In fact, I'm not saying you shouldn't learn to code, but that's actually not what it is. Because if you want to say, okay, so how do we avoid being replaced by these ever smarter but never conscious agents as machines and ever more sophisticated robots, we need to focus on our comparative advantage, to speak in the argot of economics. We need to focus on those things, really, that are absolute advantage that only we can do, that only intelligent free agents can do. Because machines will do many of the things that we're doing right now, but there's going to be an entire sort of jurisdiction that will be forever off to them. And so my argument, just very briefly, and I'll just kind of just summarize it for you, is that what we want to do is we want to adapt and develop the virtues that correspond to those five features of the information economy. Because what is a virtue? A virtue is only something that can be acquired by an intelligent agent with freedom. right? That, you know, this is just Aristotle's account. Whatever your initial habits are, you can, by force of habit, decide you're going to be a punctual person. You start out by setting the alarm and not hitting snooze ever and getting up on time, and you force yourself to do it, and you focus on it, and you eventually wake up before the alarm goes off, right, maybe. And you eventually, if you focus your attention on this, that habit gets down in your bones, and you become more than you were before. You become, in this case, a punctual person, and you develop a virtue. Notice that's the activity of an embodied agent with free will and this kind of capacity to shape and to grow ourselves. That's something that's unique to us and not to machines. So what are the virtues that you would need then if you want to deal with a world that's disruptive and exponential and digital and ever more connected and ever more informational, all those things? Well, first is courage. Because the economy is going to continue to be disruptive, whether we like it or not, courage is the virtue of being willing to act in the context of failure. Now, you know, say 100 years ago or 150 years ago when the Irish were coming to the United States, they had courage forced upon them. If your only choice is, well, starvation or privation, or get on a boat and leave everything you know behind with your few family members in hopes of something better across the sea, that has a way of kind of forcing courage upon you. But if your alternative is, well, I need to take a risk and try some things, but, you know, my parents' basement's not bad, and I'm not going to starve, right? That means if you don't cultivate courage, you're not likely to develop it because it won't be forced upon you. And so you have to be willing to act in the context of failure precisely because you don't know what's happening in 5 years. I tell every college freshman this. Don't so hyper-specialize that if something completely changes, you don't know how to do anything else. I think develop a professional or technical skill and get a broad-based liberal arts education, if you could do both of those things, so you're adaptable. But actually, just the willingness to act in the context of failure isn't the pathway to economic success, is it? You know, we all know people, you could just keep failing, right, till the very end. So you got to have a sort of add-on virtue, what I'll call anti-fragility, after Nassim Nicholas Taleb. Anti-fragility is the capacity of a system to improve when it is perturbed or disturbed. Biological systems are like this. So if you think of a person, you think of lifting weights. When you go to a gym and you lift weights, if you do it right, you really stress the muscle in your bones and your tendons, you will tear muscle fibers and create an inflammatory response. You go home and you eat right and you rest and you recuperate, your body won't just build it back the way it was. It will build it back stronger than it was before. That's anti-fragility. And that's also a capacity of agents. So when you act, whether you succeed or fail, if your failure teaches you something and makes you something you weren't before, then you learn from it and you become more than you were before. Like Scott Adams, the Dilbert guy who's now a sort of the Trump whisperer these days. But you know, but he's got this great book called How to Lose It, Fail at Almost Everything and Still Win Big. And he describes his career as one of trying and doing lots of different things, most of them mediocre. But he eventually developed a set of kind of independent skills that when he stacked them, he had this unique skill set in the entire universe, right? Through his failure and learning from it. And so that's a virtue that we need, and that's a virtue that you need in a highly disruptive and an exponentially changing economy. You need both of these things. Then you need altruism. Now, of course, we always need the type of altruism that Mother Teresa has, but in this case, I'm talking about the type of commercial altruism in which you say, okay, what is something that I could do that would create value for others, and if I do it, I might actually be able to make a living so that it's mutually beneficial. It benefits others, but it also benefits me. That's a subset of altruism. That's always been important in any sort of job market, and certainly for successful entrepreneurs. I would argue it's even more important in a digital age, because there's a lot of weird ways of creating value in terms of goods and services in the digital marketplace. And you can't really predict them ahead of time. But people that are able to figure out and anticipate the needs of others really, really well, I think are able to succeed in a digital environment. If they're not, if you're not good at that, you might still be great at World of Warcraft, but nobody's necessarily going to pay you to do it, right? That's the difference between a hobby and a job. So altruism. And then collaboration, which is obvious. Collaboration is a form of humility in which you're willing to work with others and you want and are willing to learn from others. There's a famous tech entrepreneur that says he always reminds himself that most of the smartest people in his industry worked for other companies. That's a humility, right? That you don't assume you're the smartest person in the room. And so if you're good at collaboration, that means you're able to work and learn from others. That's always been important, but it's way more important if you're just a gentleman farmer, you know, that able to sort of feed yourself. It's less significant that you are able to collaborate with others than in a hyper-connected world, in which, in principle, one of the things I do is I run an online news and commentary site. I can tell you the month of February, because of my leg, I didn't wear pants. But I kept working. I didn't have to wear pants because I'm able to see everyone actually on the content management system. And I just, if we do video, I, you know, only do it above my head. And I'm in Washington, D.C., and there's 6 staff in Texas, and then editors and contributors around the country, and in fact, around the world. And we can only do that operation of collaboration because of particular technology that allows it to be possible. And so people that are really good at doing that, that's a people skill. That's a human skill. Having a degree in computer engineering doesn't necessarily make you good at collaborating with others, right? It's going to be incredibly important. And then finally, this is the sort of crowning achievement, the most, I think, important virtue in this context is creative freedom. I always ask college students to define freedom at the beginning, and it's funny, I guess this is inscribed on our genes or something. They all say basically the same thing. So, well, freedom is when I get to do whatever I want to do, right? So if I can stay up late, or I can drink as much as I want, or I can eat whatever I want, then I'm free. But if somebody's telling me what to do, then I'm not free. Now, that's a type of freedom, but it's a really, really minimal type of freedom. It's what philosophers call freedom of indifference. If you can choose between alternatives that exclude each other, it's either chocolate or strawberry ice cream, and you can choose one or the other, that's a type of freedom, but it's also a very minimal type of freedom and not the kind of freedom the American founders were talking about. Think of it in a different context. Think about a little girl whose parents buy her a piano. And they tell her, you're free to play that piano. She's 5 years old. She's never had a piano lesson. She doesn't know how to read music. But she's free to sit down and to make noise at the keyboard. Right? Now, so is she free in that sense? Well, yeah, I guess she's more free than if there weren't a piano or her parents didn't even let her enter the room. But is she free to play Rachmaninoff or Debussy? Is she free to play that third movement of Moonlight Sonata that you never hear because it's so darn hard? No, she's not. She's actually quite limited. She's bound by her own incapacity. So how would she acquire the freedom to play Rachmaninoff? Well, she would do it by conditioning herself, by restraining herself in pursuit of a particular goal. She'd put her butt down on that bench every day. She'd play those scales and arpeggios and chords. She would run through those really hard segments of songs over and over and over again and get it down in her bones so that after maybe 10 years of this, she would finally be able to play Rachmaninoff and even play music and even perhaps create music. That's a much grander form of freedom. And so the reason I talk about the virtue of creative freedom is to make this clear. When we create value for ourselves and others, it's always going to require this type of self-discipline and conditioning, in which we focus on the wants and needs of others in our particular context, and then we are willing to adapt ourselves and adjust ourselves in order to be able to meet those needs. And those, notice, that achieve this are able to create meaningful goods and services. And remember, meaning is the essence of information, and so the essence of the information age. And so what I think actually the lesson of the information age, if you're thinking about those robots, I know you guys have watched those videos of the Boston Dynamics robots that are doing scary stuff. And there's outtakes, by the way, where they destroy themselves too, right? But if you're wondering, there are already self-driving long-haul trucks. So if you're wondering if we'll ever develop those, they already exist. If you're wondering about autonomous cars, they already exist. There's already a fleet of them in Pittsburgh, Volvo XC90s. Machines are going to do a bunch of the stuff that we're doing right now, including a lot of the mental work, not just physical work. But there's going to be a heck of a lot of other things that we're going to do, and they're not all going to be intellectual. A lot of them are going to be things we do, complex activities we do with our physical bodies. And so when we look at these machines, I think rather than saying, oh, my word, this somehow sort of reduces our status in the universe, and there are going to be these super intelligent machines that are going to replace us, we should say, where do these machines come from? They came from us. We are the ones that create them. They're an expression of our own creative capacities. We are Homo sapiens. We're also Homo faber, man the maker. And so my argument would be, no, don't panic about this. Prepare and have the proper perspective. This creature is made in the image of God. Thank you very much. And I forgot to mention, but if somebody's wondering, I make some predictions in the book, including what I think is going to happen in agriculture, and I think it's more complex than what you might be imagining, that everything's robot factories. So if anyone's curious, we can talk about that. Go ahead.
Hi, Rick Raddatz from the Pittenomic Institute. I happen to have degrees in computer science and philosophy, and so this is a very interesting topic to me. Now, of all the people I've met who are skeptics about the singularity,
yes,
I think you've done the best job giving the proponents of the singularity's argument.
Mm-hmm.
Most people who are skeptics essentially give strawman arguments.
Right.
And so I appreciate that. I happen to be someone who does believe that's the eventual destination. I just don't know when.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people that predict the timelines, that's just too big of a binary leap to predict. But I am on that side. So I'm very curious why you mentioned that you had an argument
mm-hmm.
why we as humans are not just biological machines.
Absolutely.
And so I think that's the key to your confidence that
that's right.
It won't happen. So what is that argument?
Well, the argument is, it would take me another 45 minutes, and this is the lamest thing a person can say, but it's in the book, right? It's terrible. But it involves not just the Chinese room argument, but also an analysis of what it means to be an agent. And so very quick, it's going to take me I couldn't even summarize this in 10 minutes. But actually, there's a free version of this online. Actually, at mindmatters.net is my basic argument for why agents aren't machines, and there's no more reason to think a computer is going to become an agent. That by agent, I mean a conscious, purposeful entity that can choose things for a purpose deliberately. That's what I mean by an agent. There's no more reason to think the machines we make will become agents like us than to think that a tractor that's big enough is going to become an ox. It's just, I think, a metaphysical confusion. And just the fact that we make them look like us, we make machines to do things like us and to do them better. That's why we make wheelbarrows. They carry things better than we do. But I also think that if you look at actual human preferences, including something that Mark Mitchell, I think, mentioned right at the beginning, he's worried that maybe this idea about the kind of locavore movement and artisanal products is a fad. I actually think it indicates something significant in the economy. I think there's actually a trend here. And so what I actually predict, this is my prediction, any kind of economic theory that can't make any prediction that's risky, should be a little suspect. And so here's mine, is that what we're going to see in the agricultural sector is simultaneously an increase in what you might call commodification or automation. So you could have hydroponic farms in deserts in Spain, tended to by self-repairing autonomous, more or less autonomous drones, and also people spending five times as much on many of the same kinds of goods from farms near their house, from people that they know. And so you might do what exactly my wife and I do, which is that we buy those hydroponic Boston bib lettuce at Costco because they're an amazing deal, and we also buy stuff at the farmer's market. And I think that actually, I think what this is it's a trend in which people actually start to value different kinds of things. When certain kinds of goods become commodities, we start favoring, for various reasons, very specifically concrete human things. And so I think we're actually at the beginning of a trend on that. So that's a long rambling answer. Thanks, sorry.
Thank you. I'm Steve Balch from Texas Tech, and putting Ray Kurzweil aside
yes.
for a moment, I'm not convinced by the argument that that there aren't a lot of people who eventually will find themselves out of work
mm-hmm.
because of machines. And what really that comes down to is there a class of people who it will not be profitable to pay as opposed to employing a machine?
Right.
You know, there was once a noble race of horses, and they were all over the economy in all kinds of ways, indispensable for
right.
pulling and hauling and transportation and riding. They're virtually all gone.
And the buggy whip.
Right.
And more directly, the buggy whip makers, right?
Who well, and all the, human people. Jobs. But I'm not talking about yeah. humans here.
Yeah.
My analogy is with the horses.
And that's where I disagree with you,
well,
because
wait a
we're
second.
Not horses. Yeah.
The good news you presented is good news for intellectuals and creative
Absolutely
people.
Absolutely not.
But
that's wrong. That's
there
wrong.
Are a lot, yeah. but, no, I don't yeah. think you're right.
Let me give you a couple
there, are a lot of people who are not particularly intellectual and who are not particularly creative, who have IQs, you know, 100 and
yeah.
downward,
right.
Who are, in fact, not going to be able to be profitably employed by someone who has an alternative in buying kind of cheap automated equipment. Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem to me at least obvious that that's not
no,
going to happen.
That's
and
right.
If it happens, it could happen on a large scale. So
yeah,
that's my question.
It doesn't seem obvious, but I also think it's wrong. The horse thing, that's precisely my point. We're neither machines nor horses. We're humans. Secondly, and I had to just sort of gloss over this, there is nothing about the information economy that means that physical labor is easily replaced. You know what's easily replaced? Mental activities. We do not have a machine that can do what any three-year-old can do with his hands. All right, and it's for very specific, it's called Moravec's paradox. We had machines that could beat people at chess, Garry Kasparov, decades ago. That's a supreme intellectual activity. Right now in this economy, there's something like 4 or 5 million skilled trade jobs that are going unfilled. Rosie the robot housekeeper, that's going to be a long time coming before actuarialists are looking for something else to do and computer coders. In fact, the complex things that we do with our bodies. Now, long-haul truckers, if that's your plan A for the next 30 years, that's a problem. But I'm guessing that most long-haul truckers also have capacities with their bodies. And so I'm not saying they need to learn to code. What they will probably do is skilled trade work, which I think will continue to be valued and will probably be more valued for different kinds of reasons. And this is why I'm calling, I mean, think about right now in Washington, D.C., where I live, right? I mean, it's just an urban, you know, hellscape, right, basically, for all sorts of reasons. And if you Google organic family-owned farms, within 20 miles, you'll find between 40 and 50 of these little farms around the outside of Washington, D.C. Why is that happening? That's actually happening because of consumer preferences, right? If you had predicted, and somebody told you, you know, in the 60s, we're going to get really good at producing and transporting and roasting coffee. And so eventually coffee is, you know, everybody's going to just spend 1 cent on coffee. Well, I don't know, but Catholic University maintains 3 Starbucks by itself. All right, so what's happened? Well, people start preferring these different kind of bespoke products and goods and services. And I don't think there's any reason to assume that suddenly we're just not going to like anything that has anything to do with humans. We're going to want robots providing everything for us. In fact, if you're a diagnostician, you're going to probably rely on Watson to do the diagnosing of the images. You're not going to bother because it's way better. But if you're able to tell people that they have cancer and to do it better than another doctor, that's going to still gain a premium. So I just fundamentally disagree that this is going to be good only for intellectuals and not for people that do manual labor. It's going to be a different kind of manual labor. I totally agree. It's going to kill factory work that involves highly repetitive sort of assembly line labor. But that is, then there's whole towns built around that. But it is also an artifact of the 20th century. It's not a kind of eternal verity. But I do not think it's going to replace either all intellectual activity or all physical activity. It's much more subtle and interesting.
My concluding comment here is that I think there are a lot of remarkably untalented people in the world. And I suspect, misanthrope though I may be, that they're going to be in trouble.
They're in trouble now, I suppose, right?
So, yeah, it could be. Yeah. Hi, Jay. Rob Koons, University of Texas. Great talk. And, I mean, of all the techno-optimists out there, you're the most persuasive. You've almost got me persuaded. And I would like to believe you.
I don't even think of... Do I seem like a techno-optimist here? I guess,
Well,
I'm an optimist about human adaptability,
anyway.
I suppose.
Compared to me, because I'm still worried.
Yeah,
so
okay, gotcha.
And I want you to relieve these worries a bit more. And it's very much along the lines that Steve raised.
Yeah.
I mean, there are certain... I mean, the question is the variety and quality of the jobs that will exist, and whether that will fit the variety of human beings there are.
Right.
And so there are human beings from time immemorial who have been really enjoyed getting their hands dirty in the muck, extracting things, and moving things around.
Yeah.
Right. That's an attractive profession for people who pulled, who led mule trains and led wagons and now drive trucks. It looks to me like those jobs are going to be gone, right? Extracting and moving things, physical things, will be entirely done by robots. There will then be people, I think, whose aptitudes are such that it's not clear to me what they're going to end up doing. So that's part one. Yeah. Part two, on the other point, I'm very encouraged by what you said about artisans, mm-hmm. right? But I wonder if that doesn't, I mean, that depends on the culture, I think.
Absolutely.
So, in other words, you're not saying it's inevitable there'll be jobs.
No.
But that we need to rethink our culture in such a way that we start valuing those things, or continue to value those things.
So absolutely.
Great. Okay.
I think that's right. Though I'm hopeful because I'm making the argument based only on current consumer trends, right? I'm not trying to make this metaphysical argument. And it crosses the political spectrum. I think Mark Mitchell made a point about that. He's worried that, okay, you know, when you've got the barista working at Starbucks talking this way, I actually think there's something kind of more fundamental, and I think what it is it corresponds to a Kuznets curve in that when certain things become commoditized, we suddenly get more interested in other things, and we prize those. And I tell some stories like that. But you are right that it is hard to picture what the jobs would be, right? But that's always, this is the seen and the unseen problem. And so you finally have to decide, okay, well, at least based on historical trends, that would always have been true. Remember, farmers, I'm not saying there was no disruption. There was disruption. Yeah. But they had very few alternatives, if any, right?
I mean, there was some permanent loss there, I think.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. My grandfather, there was loss, and it was slow. But my argument would be, if anything, most people, right now I'm not talking about handicap, you know, or the 60 IQ, but that most people, there will be lots of things that we will be able to do and that will be valued, some of which we can't anticipate, some of which, the artisanal, what I call bespoke labor, in which what I think is happening is that labor, rather than being merely an input, a special kind of labor is becoming an output, so that people value, I want a casket that is made by hand by this guy, Marcus Daly, and not by a machine. Right, and that's a value, right? In the subjective theory of economic value, that's a value. So I'm trying to give a sort of strategy for here's how I think we can adapt. But the first thing is to kind of understand what's happening. Thanks, Rob. Those are good, great points.
Thanks, Jay. Mm-hmm. Dave Deevil, University of St. Thomas. You focused on the role of making meaning and understanding mm-hmm. meaning for the future. And one of the things that I've been thinking about, especially since Jeff Tucker's talk, is this question of the technology that we have already and the way right. in which we use it. And it seems that in order for us to keep doing those sorts of things, and maybe this is just a generational thing, but mm-hmm. it seems that kids need to grow up in a sort of analog culture
yeah.
and then experience the digital because yeah. the digital culture is so engulfing.
It is.
I don't. And
it will become more engulfing.
Yeah. And unless we, you know, I read these things about how tech executives don't let their kids have
yeah.
very much screen time or
yeah.
anything like that. And I was glad that you said that, you know, you encourage students to get a liberal arts degree as well.
Yeah.
But, I mean, is the pessimistic side then that too many people are going to be engulfed by the digital and we really won't have enough meaning makers in the future? Or is that too
well,
pessimistic as
well? I think that
well?
Meaning makers are going to be, I mean, I think there's going to be an economic incentive to be a meaning maker because there's going to be, you know, just in sort of purely utilitarian economic terms, I think that those things end up being prized. Now, a lot of us might not really like some of the meaning that's being made, right, which is a matter of culture because, you know, what we want is for people to desire and to want good things. But I do think, I mean, this is that's why I say the key difficulty is the pace of disruption rather than permanent technological unemployment. Because, say, developing virtuous children, developing a culture, right, takes a certain amount of time. It still takes 18 to 30 years, right, to raise kids. It just does. And so it's not like that's conforming to Moore's Law. And so I think that's the kind of thing that we should spend our intellectual time on and not worry about the robots waking up and, you know, killing us all or something. We might kill each other with our robots, but that's a different thing.
Hi, Rick Nathan. I'm an electrical engineer, so I was really excited to hear you talking
great.
About Claude Shannon.
Yeah,
I think he's one of the most important figures of the 20th century and not well known outside of
that's
engineering.
True.
I think, though, that his theory of information does state that the entropy the value of or the amount of information in a bit string is dependent on its probability. So
that's right. No, that's what uniform. I said. What he does, it's on entropy or improbability. So he gets that half of it.
I think that from a philosophical standpoint, there's a concept by a Russian mathematician, Kolmogorov complexity. I think that might be a more useful...
Absolutely.
Not from an engineering standpoint, but from thinking about it. And that's basically saying that if you have a string, you have a piece of information, its information content is represented by the shortest way to represent that string. And so like a 1,000 A's, you know, you can represent less than 1,000 characters
right.
if you have
1,000
random characters. Anyway, from a philosophical standpoint, I think it's easier to think about. But I actually think, looking to the future, there's this big push or focus on digital, and I think that we're at the brink of another revolution in terms of material properties and manufacturing.
Absolutely.
And so, for instance, I just picked up a 3D printer. I've been printing all sorts of things.
Yeah.
So to me, it seems like we're about to experience, you know, this revolution of in the physical world, and... You know, that will – I wonder if you could comment on that.
Absolutely, and I have a whole section in the book on this because I talked about digitization as the movement from the world of atoms to the world of bits. 3D printers is the movement from the world of bits to the world of atoms, right? And so if you think of manufacturing in the 20th century, it was mostly intensive and centralized economies of scale, right, factories in particular locations. 3D printing represents a way of manufacturing that pushes them back out to the periphery. And so you can buy. So this is why I actually think what's actually happening is more interesting and not nearly as simple as the dystopians or the utopians are saying, because we're humans and not machines. And we're the ones making these machines. And so we should expect, I mean, we are, Mark Mitchell said, we're embodied souls. We're this unique hybrid of the spiritual and the material, the breath of God and the dust of the earth, and so we should expect that the kind of nexus of our creativity is going to include both immaterial things and material things, both information and then information being embedded in something. And you're right, though, that material science is a place where a lot of this stuff is happening, and that's, I mean, a lot of that stuff, I try to follow that, is really mind-blowing. Thank you.
Hi, thank you very much for your talk. Mm-hmm. About a year ago, I moderated a panel for the Veritas Forum on artificial intelligence and faith.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And on that panel, we had Dr. Rosalind Picard, who works at MIT, very involved in this issue. And she was debating or engaging with a panel of Wharton professors who were very supportive of the idea of artificial intelligence and singularity.
Strong artificial intelligence.
Correct,
right.
Yes.
Gotcha.
And her argument was that any type of robot we can create right now is only responding to us and engaging with us in the form of an algorithm, so everything is predetermined.
Yeah.
Do you think, given that that already is in existence to some sense, even in our phones and Siri and things like that,
sure.
is that a threat to human empathy? And have we seen...
To human what?
Human empathy.
Empathy.
And are, since anything we can say to a robot like that is not going to evoke any types of feelings, do you think that's going to cause changes in ourselves and in our children in the future with the way we relate to people?
I think it can. But I also think that what happens is we also become much more sophisticated about these things. So, you know, Google search passes the Turing test for anybody in the 1950s, right? It almost does some days for me. But we all know perfectly well that's not what's happening. Now, it's a little more complicated than machines that are not just using predetermined algorithms, because in machine learning, of course, it's collecting data and kind of writing itself. Nevertheless, it's system set up to do that. There's not an agent choosing. And so what I suspect will happen is that we will become ever more sophisticated and subtle at telling the difference between AI, I'm talking about weak artificial intelligence, so the activities that mimic the activities of intelligent agents, and actual agents. And we'll just get better and better at doing that. People try to fool us, of course, right, with Mechanical Turks and things like that. And maybe there will be psychological problems that people have, like in the series Humans, in which some kids start acting like the synths, right? I don't know, you know, but I don't think, I'm less frightened about this primarily because I'm absolutely convinced that there's a metaphysical flaw at the center of this strong AI program that once you reduce humans to machines, then that's terrifying. But if you have good reason to think, no, you're making a fundamental mistake. Because of the limits of your kind of metaphysical resources in your worldview, you're assuming that. And the good news is we can make predictions. And I'm making a prediction that the machines are not going to wake up. That's not going to happen.
So, thank you.
Yeah, you bet.
Michael Swisher from Stillwater, Minnesota. As I listened to some of the previous conversation, and in particular Steve Balch's question and your answer to it, the thought ran through my mind that, you know, I've often thought the same thing. And at the time of the 1900 census, the two most numerous classes of occupation were domestic service and agricultural labor.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're among the smallest classes.
Right.
And yet, listen to the discussion of how horses were once ubiquitous and now rendered obsolete. I should tell you, I live in an ex-urban area, which was formerly an agricultural area, mm-hmm. primarily, and I've been credibly told that we have more horses today there than we did 100 years ago.
Yeah.
The difference is, of course, that then they were necessities and now they're luxuries.
Yeah.
And I wonder if the same may not be so of various classes of labor that we think are going to be rendered obsolete, so that an agricultural laborer or housemaid may have been dispensed with, but at some point those people are still going to be around that have the capacity to do those jobs, and they will be luxuries.
And they will be valued.
And there will be value in them, and demand will expand to take up existing supply. Say's law will out.
Yeah, that's essentially my prediction, is that you know, that Mark Zuckerberg, even if you have a Rosie the Robot nanny, right, and it's only 1995 or whatever, he doesn't want that. He wants actual human beings that he's willing to pay a premium to do those things. And so it may be that the kind of domestic servants that existed in a previous generation will reappear, but they'll be at a completely different level economically, because we're going to, you know, be much further along, at least in terms of per capita GDP and things like that. So I think, you know, if I'm right, if there's something specific about humans and we recognize that and we value that, that we're going to just find both things that we hadn't thought of that people will do, and also things that people used to do that will now have new meaning, because, well, you can get this made by a robot, right, or you can get this made by a person. I do this. I have an exquisite knowledge of a particular handmade French tie global market that you can buy on eBay because they're handmade, right? And is this irrational? Yeah, probably. But I want that more than the $2 robot tie from China for some reason. And I suspect that's a kind of, there's something there, you know, and I think it just has to do. Yeah. Great.
George Gilder has this discussion of that thinks there'll be a move from digital to analog,
right,
and from silicon to carbon.
Yeah.
So what do you think of that?
I think that that's right. The digital to analog is complicated, but I do think that there's nothing unique about silicon. In fact, what's unique in the universe is carbon in terms of its information-bearing properties. And so I suspect that we're going to reach the physical limits of crystalline silica, and that's what we happen to be using now. But even if Moore's law ends there, if the trend continues, I don't think it's a physical law like kind of Ray Kurzweil does, but I also think that the trend is suggestive and that we will move to photonics, or we'll use carbon chemistry and we'll do something better. And it's actually much better at coding information. And so I suspect something like that will happen, but it's going to be entirely dependent upon human creativity and freedom and not on any kind of inevitable law of progress. Is that it? Thanks so much. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Well, a couple of quick announcements, and then we'll break. Everyone is invited to join us in the Explore Room, which is just out here, and keep going to the left, and you'll see the signs for it. It's for a complimentary reception in celebration of the Society's 55th anniversary. And it's not entirely complimentary, but remember, you have a red ticket on the back of your badge that gives you a free drink. So take your badge with you and wave your ticket in front of them, and you'll get a free drink. And then after that, it's a cash bar, but you'll at least get going. And thanks to our sponsors for this reception, the Fund for American Studies, Heartland Institute, the Ashbrook Center at Ashland University, and Mr. John Thomas. Second announcement, the Sunday morning breakfast tomorrow will be in the Grand Ballroom. It will start at 8 to 9, or actually it'll be open at 7:30 for early birds, but the official time is 8 to 9. And then don't neglect, if you're still here, and I hope you will be, the session, The Future of Truth. What could be more gripping than that? We have really a great roundtable panel for that. So that's from 9 to 11, and then we finish. But today, we are finished. So thank you all.